Coming back from Challenger Camp, the trip came in through Kennewick last Sunday and then stopped here for a little bit. Visited a little going through, had Derek with me. He came down and met us at Boise, and so we had a chance to spend some time together. I just want to say the camp was remarkably good. Those that are heading off to Davidson, Davidson attendance usual run in excess of 100. Challenger camp this year had 26. So you can imagine the difference in the scale in terms of how the focus is. Challenger camp is a leadership mentoring program. It is a program where we're taking the older teens and some of the younger adults in that sense and trying to work with them in a very personal way to build their focus, to strengthen their hand. We're trying to take young people that are already focused and committed in terms of the church and God's way and work with them as compared to attracting people to God's way. Now, the camp program as a whole deals with a much broader perspective of our young people in the church, whereas Challenger Camp is effectively a graduate camp. And it gives us an opportunity to accomplish something, I think, in a remarkable way. It was as fine a group as we've ever had, in part because when you reduce the numbers, you can increase the focus of the counselors, of the staff in various ways, and you can increase the element of how you produce your environment around them. You have a little more control in that way. But every single thing we did, I guess an example I would give you, everything we needed done, all we had to say was, who can help set up the kitchen? Who can bring in the tables to eat? Who can set a tarp over the back of the trailer? Who can put up the tent? There was never a time when we couldn't just say, who can, and the hands would go up, and two, three, or four people would line up and say, I can do that. I'll be happy to do that. There was not a single time when they weren't ready to jump in and contribute in that way. That was impressive to all of us. When you can get a group of young people that are fired up and excited about participating, much can be done. We are trying to produce a Challenger camp, and we're able to produce that in the other camps, what we call the zone. Challenger camp, because you have smaller numbers, more staff, and you have an environment that is dramatic in terms of the Tetons, I think we were able to accomplish that, again, with a little older group of participants in a little stronger way. We're trying to produce an environment where we can say, this is how God does it. These are the relationships that God would have us to build. This is the instruction that God would have us to give you, at least as much as we know and understand. Doing that in the Tetons, again, is dramatic. I came up as we were setting up one part of our course one morning, and James Kappa was down the hill a little below me. He had to go back for some batteries for his radio, and so I had gone up on the side of the range by myself, and I came up through a draw and around the corner, and literally 10, 15 yards in front of me, a herd of elk literally jumped up right out of their beds in front of me. 20, 25 elk, you know, calves amongst them went thundering over the top of the hill. And James Kappa, down below me, watched these come over the top of the hill, run down and veer off and then mew back and forth, you know, the mothers for the calves and cry back and forth to build themselves back into a herd. And then when he came up, we watched them below the hill just come around the edge and work their way up the side beside us. It really is a dramatic setting. We came down off of a trail one evening doing some scouting with the rock climbing crew, and there was a large buck mule deer 10 yards off the side of the trail, big rack coming in all in velvet, and he was just sitting there eating, and he would look up and he just simply watched us walk by. It was as if he was just tame and we were in a zoo, and yet we were out in the open in that sense in wilderness. So there is an opportunity there to show God's hand. You know, Mike was talking about, you know, what is man that you are mindful of him? And we can take young people and put them in an environment that shows God's hand, and it shows it in a dramatic way. We have rock climbing, which I work with, backpacking, which Mr. Scriber was there and he now works with, and also a challenge course, which is a map and compass course where you have to build a rope bridge, do orienteering, you have to cross a boulder scree field, a very large field through open country, and you have to find trailheads and face certain challenges, a medical emergency. We build in challenges around the course, and it's a team-building exercise. So we do things that are challenging, and we do things that are fun. But what we're trying to do is build into young people a spiritual focus. We're trying to take those lessons, or at least those activities, and build in lessons to them to reinforce things in a right and proper way. Randy Stiver was there this year running the challenge course. He is preparing the video on camp for next spring. And so some of the filming that will have been done there and other places through the year are going to be in the camp video next year. Title of the camp video is Camp 24/7. You know, God's Immersion Education Program. So all he talked about the whole time we were in camp together was how camp is a total immersion program where we bring our young people in and totally surround them with an environment to produce, again, as much as we are able to encourage a spiritual focus. Some people use that in trying to learn a foreign language. They will go into the culture where the language is used, where all they hear is that language. All the transactions, all of their activities, all the conversation have to be in that language. What we are trying to do is immerse them in God's way, where all the conversations, where all the transactions, where all the relationships are built and maintained God's way. And then we're trying to give them that strength and that boost. It isn't enough, brethren, for us to sit around and wait for the world tomorrow. How many times have we cried out and yearned openly, "Oh, thy kingdom come"? We do. We yearn for God's kingdom. And we yearn for this world's ways, and the values of this system, Satan's system, to be gone and replaced by what God is doing. In the church, though, we cannot afford to be just waiting for the world tomorrow. We don't do that in the camp program. We're trying to bring that here today. You know, here in the Tetons, as we have our program, there are elk, and there's deer, and there's bear. We jumped up a couple of bear. Mr. Stiver literally walked up on a grizzly on the trail. And he's the one that was teaching the campers on how to deal with bears. And he was the one who got to practice. And what we would do on the challenge course, Cody Kitts is on the rock climbing staff, and there was a trail that went right by a burned out tree. And Cody would put in all black and then take the soot from the tree, and he smeared it all over his face and totally blacked out his skin, and he would hide in the hollow of this tree. And then as each team would go by, he would jump out and attack them. Now, Mr. Stiver had told them, do not scream, do not run away. Make yourself as big as possible. Stay together. And, you know, a screaming camper is like a wounded rabbit. Sounds like dinner. Just that scream sounds like dinner bell being rung to a bear. And so he educated them, and it was so incredible because one of the groups went by, and I won't tell you who, but one of the young men was the team leader for the group, and when Cody came roaring out of that tree, he just hit the trail running. And Cody literally, because this was a surprise. We didn't tell him there would be a bear attack. Cody tackled him from behind, just like it would have been a bear attack, you know. And this young man was just about to lose it. We probably had to give him a little Paxil when it was all done. But it was a good object lesson. So Mr. Stiver's the one who got to meet the grizz. And it was a young grizz, maybe only, you know, comes up to your ribs maybe. And it didn't have the hump on it yet, but it had, you know, it was juvenile going into adult. So he got up and he put his camera and tripod up in the air and goes, whoa, whoa, you know, and he's jumping up and down, and the grizz just ran right over the bank and down the creek and off to the side. So he has now since written up a large, noble, brave story of how he confronted this grizzly and chased him down the hill. And but it was, there were a lot of remarkable events. I wish I could just tell you everything that happened at camp and not have to go through in some structured format, because it is dramatic, some of the circumstances and things that we experienced along the way. There's a movie came out fairly recently, War of the Worlds. I didn't see it. Tom Cruise was in it. I usually go to everything Tom Cruise is in, of course. But there was a radio program, I do know that much, Orson Welles, if we go back into the 30s, that at least the movie was loosely based on. And the concept is that it portrayed two worlds at war with each other. And one or the other would have to be destroyed for one of the other two to actually come out and survive. Isn't that amazing in that context? We are trying in the camp program to take young people and put them into God's world in an environment where we set that up around them. A complete immersion program. Satan is the god of this world, and we live in the midst of a war that is taking place between those two commands. One of the young people who was there this year had the courage, and I thought it took a lot of courage, because every night we have the Christian leadership around the campfire. And the block of time for that is an hour and a half, and it's a complete open discussion. They'll ask us a question, and we answer it. We ask them a question. We go through some biblical principles on many things, and many times then it carries over into the time that remains afterwards in discussion. But one of the young people said, I here am in an environment that I really want. I desire this when I am here. But she said, when I am home, it is another world. And she said, that world is desirable to me as well. And she says, I want to want this one. But I know when I go home, I will be tempted by the other. And I thought that was remarkable. Open admission about that battle that is fought by our young people, by ourselves, all of us, in that way. Of course, when she said that, everybody began to advise her on how to get rid of the old world and how to buy into the new world, but she literally exposed herself a little bit emotionally to express that. But what was impressive to me, more than just the courage I think she had to admit that she fought that battle, as we all do, but later on in the camp, there was a half a day when the group all went into Jackson and they had a chance to go through some of the shops. And she went and bought herself a necklace. And on the necklace was a little ring and it said, remember. And she came up to me after they returned from Jackson and she showed me her necklace. And she says, look what I bought. And she said, I want to remember what was here. And she bought that as a reminder of the world that she was in camp when she went back home, and again recognizing that that other world would be attractive to her as well. She wanted to remember what was there. Paul addresses this context, this contest, this battle that was fought in his own mind and members in Romans 7. He describes his life as a Christian, as a war that was being fought, with what the flesh desired and what the mind indeed rightly knew to be true. Romans 7 and verse number 19. He says, the good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil that I will not to do, that I practice. Now this is very open admission as well, a very strong context. I would put it in the context of all the other scriptures. Paul said, take that person who's practicing sexual immorality in Corinth and cast him out of the congregation. So Paul is not saying that he gave himself over to sin, but he is saying there's a battle in his mind. There's a war of the worlds taking place, and he wants to remember, he wants to do that which is right. But it is a major contest. He says, now if I do what I will not to do, it's no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good, for I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. He says, I love God's law, but my flesh is drawn away. He says, I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind, bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, describing the difficulty sometimes of the battle that he faced. who will deliver me from this body of death? And then he gives the answer in verse 25. He says, I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord for delivering me, for working with me, for coming under the shed blood of Jesus Christ. So then with my mind I serve the law of God, with the flesh the law of sin. 2 Corinthians takes this in a little different context, shows the other side of the coin. You know, when Paul talks about the battle and struggle in his flesh, he speaks of it very strongly. And yet when he speaks about the Holy Spirit and the power of the Spirit, he speaks about that very strongly as well. And so the context is based on where the emphasis is being put. But in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse number 3, Paul addresses this in a little different way. He says, though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal or physical, but they're mighty in God for pulling down strongholds. It's like describing a siege engine coming up to a wall of a fort, and it is a mighty engine able to tear down the strongholds, to break down those walls. Casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. That is the battle that is being fought. Another one of the campers came up to me in the course of the activities. And again, when you have 26 campers and you have, I don't know if I want to say it publicly, more than that staff. We had a lot of staff. You have kitchen staff, you have rock climbing staff, you have, you know, counselors, and you have various people doing various things. Proportionately in that camp, when the numbers reduce of the campers, the staff numbers don't reduce by the same proportion because you have activities that still have to be manned. So you have a lot of one-on-one focus with the people who are there. And we talk to them. We spend time with them. And we go to the tent at night when they're bedding down, and we pray with them before they go to bed and answer their questions. But one of the young people came up to me who came from an area where they had very few church members. She had very few friends in the church in that respect. The congregation was very small. And she was describing what it was like back home. And then she said, I would give everything I have for this. To be in the zone. To be in God's way. To be with people in the church. To be in an environment that was the right way, doing the right thing in the right time. But I thought that was interesting. She didn't say I'd give up my family. That's not her point. But her friends, not in the church. Her activities outside of the church. All that environment, she says, I would give everything I have up for this. And I just thought that was very encouraging. It was encouraging to me. Brethren, what world are we in? Which world are we fighting for? And which world do we resist? When Christ looked at the disciples, he saw them as being in this world, but not of it. Not of those values. John 17, when he's praying, he very clearly addresses this, that he had no intent to remove them from the environment of this world, but he didn't want them buying in. He wanted them protected from the evil one. He wanted them protected from Satan's system. But yet they still had to exist in its midst. John 17, verse 11, he addresses this in his prayer. As he's preparing for his own death, he says, I am no longer in the world, but these are in the world. And I come to you, Holy Father, keep through your name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in your name. Those whom you gave me I have kept, and none of them is lost except the son of perdition, that the scripture might be fulfilled. Now I come to you, Christ going to God, going to his throne. And these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. He speaks of a world war in a spiritual sense. Satan's system versus God's system. and he calls it indeed the world. I did not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They're not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. And as you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself, that they may also be sanctified by the truth. He just uses the term over and over and over again. Hurricane Katrina wasn't that long ago, was it? It was last fall. And the video images that came flooding in our TV sets, mainly about New Orleans, obviously the whole Gulf Coast had some impact, but a lot of it came out of New Orleans. And there were two main images that came through repeatedly. There were owners and there were participants. There were owners of businesses and there were owners of property and homes who stayed in their homes to protect them or tried to bring back product and open their businesses. They were sharing with people who had nothing. They were unloading the stores and the stockpiles of the things that they had and trying to get back on their feet. And then there were the participants, at least as I would call them, who did not have, in that sense, that same sense of ownership. Maybe they had an apartment, somebody else's apartment. If the building was destroyed, it wasn't their money, it was somebody else's. They had a job, but it wasn't maybe necessarily a job that they had a particular affinity for. It was something that they were doing because it needed to be done. But they weren't the owner. And those people just literally flooded out of New Orleans, and many of them, I'm sure, will never go back. But the owners had investment to protect, and they had an obligation also to rebuild. In the church, are we owners or are we participants? Is it our church? Is this our congregation? Is it our personal responsibility that this will succeed and be rebuilt and strengthened, or is it somebody else's problem? If we just occupy a rental apartment and have a meaningless job in the church, in our mind, then when there is trouble, we will simply walk away. But if it is ours, and if we have investment in it, and if we have investment for God, then we will take responsibility to see that the work gets done ourselves. We will take it in a very personal way. John chapter 10, verse number 11, puts this in a, portrays it in another way. John 10, verse number 11. I am the good shepherd, Christ says. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep because they're his sheep. He's not working for somebody else and it's their sheep. He says, no, these are my sheep. He says the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But he is a hireling, just a participant. And not the shepherd, the one who doesn't own the sheep, sees the wolf come in and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he's a hireling and doesn't care about the sheep. He's just being paid to do what he does. It's not his. If this is not our congregation, if Christianity and serving God, if he is not our God and we are his people, then when trouble comes, we simply turn and walk away. I am the good shepherd and I know my sheep and I am known by my own. As the Father knows me, even so I know the Father. I lay down my life for the sheep. Pretty direct, pretty dramatic. Other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I must bring. They will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. Therefore my Father loves me, because I lay down my life, that I may take it again. And verse 18 is important. Because you can't make somebody be an owner. A person who is an owner has to choose to take ownership. When we were working, again, with our young people, we were trying to show them that they had to take ownership, in that sense, of their faith. It couldn't be the God of their mother or their father, or the God of their uncle or their brother. God had to become their God. And his words had to become the words that they personally were committed to. Not something that somebody told them to do, or expected them to do, but something that they did because they believed it was theirs to do by God's call. Verse 18, no one takes it from me. I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down. I have power to take it again. This command I've received from my Father. Appreciated Mike's sermonette in terms of the creation. Appreciated him stealing scriptures that I had down about the creation. But again, God's hand is so personal, the way he will overlay a message and build it so that we might learn in a very related and intimate way. The more we see God's hand in the creation, and again, I'm thinking in context of a camp where we're out in the open and there are elk herds and the deer and even the bear just filling this valley and the carved mountains and the fabulous rock that rises up so majestically. It is incredible. But the more we see God's hand in the creation, and we are part of his creation, he is working, building, molding, and shaping us, then the more personal our relationship with him becomes, and the more his world becomes our world. Isn't that what God does when he calls us? Now, when God is calling a young person growing up in the church, it's a process. When he calls someone out of the world who is in the world, it's much more specific, much more a point in time. But what God shows us is that he is God, he is true, then that the Bible is his word. And then we begin to take that on, we take ownership and begin to apply it in our lives. Oh, I think I will quit smoking. Oh, I don't think I'll do those things anymore. I won't speak those words. I won't dress those ways. I won't deal with people after that manner. We begin to take that on and they become our values. So when we see God's hand in his creation or in our lives, our relationship with him personalizes and our commitment is able to deepen in that way. Another one of the young men that was a camper there, when he went up on the backpacking trip, as we come back and they're all excited, I mean, they're all together, you could just see this energy that was coming off of them and how beautiful it had been and how dramatic the trip had been. And so as we're then talking that night during Christian living, he described the mountains as having been able to go up and see what God had molded. I mean, he's describing a piece of granite as something that God molded with his own hands. I liked what he said because that's the way I tend to think of the creation myself. Evolution is no more than an attempt to discredit God. I don't care who believes it or how they justify it. Evolution is simply an attempt to take God's hands out of his creation in people's eyes. When I think of the Grand Canyon, you know, you can think of the Grand Canyon as a big ditch in rock and dirt that has been cut over just millions and millions and millions of years. And you just run a hose down there long enough and it'll take dirt out every year and wash it out the other end and someday you get the Grand Canyon. You can look at the Grand Canyon that way. I do not. I look at the Grand Canyon as something that God specifically has molded with his hands. I don't think something like that on the scale of what God is doing and the way God works, I don't think it just happens. And I think Scripture indicates clearly that it doesn't just happen that way as well. You know, why are the major mountain ranges where they are? If they were in other places, the weather patterns and the flow of the earth and the currents in the oceans would all be different. Life on this earth and in the places where there's fertile land has been designed by God. Now, man has impacted that process without question. But look at Psalm 147 and then think in terms of God's active creation, not only in the features of this earth, but going beyond that into the people that he has called us into his service. Psalm 147 and verse number 12. I think the concept of evolution inputs into our mind the concept that everything is just going to happen naturally over time. Not life coming from non-life. No, we don't accept that. But I think the concept of evolution in our mind implies, well, the mountain ranges evolved and the rivers evolved. You know, why in the world is there a Mississippi-Missouri River system in the dead middle of the United States that drains most of the mass of our country? When I go to Montana, the Missouri River is flowing north to Great Falls. When we lived in Omaha, the Missouri River was flowing south right through our city going the other way. And it drains and provides portage and access to much of this land. Isn't that a coincidence? Such a phenomenal, rich river system that opened the middle of this country to shipping and commerce just happened to have drained itself out over time in that specific place. I don't believe it. I think evolution causes us to think of what God has created with purpose. The fact that the gold was in California and not on the East Coast. So when the time came for God prophetically to begin to settle this land with his people, the descendants of Abraham according to his blessings, all he had to do is kind of pick off a few and expose where it lay, and this land was instantly settled. There's no question that the oil that is in the Middle East is there prophetically held for the time to when end time events could be fulfilled, so that the king of the South could have his oil pocket to sit on and begin to strive in his mind to be a ruler of the world. You could expand that, you could say with the Spanish Armada, God's intervention, but I'm saying in the creation itself, I believe it didn't just happen. God put it there. Psalm 147. I think when we see that, when we think of that, then we look more about God's power at those planets, and we look at what he has done and how he holds and maintains it all in its place. Psalm 147, verse 12. Praise the Lord, O Jerusalem. Praise your God, O Zion, for he has strengthened the bars of your gates. He has blessed your children within you. He makes peace in your borders, fills you with the finest wheat. He sends out his command to the earth. His word runs very swiftly. He gives snow like wool. Of course, that's just a word picture, right? I don't think so. He scatters the frost like ashes. He casts out his hail like morsels. Who can stand before his cold? He sends out his word and melts them, causes his wind to blow and the waters flow. I think it describes God's active presence in his creation and the way that he formed and built this earth to function as it does. We can try to predict that as much as we can. We can watch those currents come in over the oceans, and in many respects we can see how God is doing it. But it is his active hand that causes this earth to work the way it does. He put Israel in a land where they would have to depend on his blessing, where they couldn't, like they did in Egypt, go and pump water out of the Nile with their foot and then tell God, I don't need you, I'll do as I please. He put them in a place where they would depend on his active blessing. And is it not interesting when God talks about Egypt and the kingdom of God, at least in that time, when they refused to come up and keep the Feast of Tabernacles, he says, I'll withhold your rain. He will actively intervene in the weather and cause it to be a curse to those who refuse to obey him. His hand is in the creation. His hand is in our life. When we see that, when we look at a mountain in terms of what God has molded, it is more personal. And the fact is, it reminds us of his world, of his kingdom, and of his power and authority. What is the mission of the church, as best that we understand it? In the emblem that we use in United Church of God, we put on there two statements: preach the gospel and prepare people. Matthew 24 says, the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness. Preach the gospel. We believe that that is our responsibility. Matthew 28, go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them, teaching them all these things. Prepare people. So we believe that the mission of the church is to both preach the gospel and care for those, care for the sheep that come as a result of that preaching being done by God's call. How does an owner look at the church's mission? How does a participant look at the mission? If you're a participant, then somebody else has responsibility for those things. But if you're an owner, then the survival of the business requires the industry of your own hand. And I don't mean God pushed aside. I mean you will work as if it was your own private industry. You will be on the team because it will be your team. It's not somebody else's team. You, in that sense, are the owner, or one of the owners. But you take responsibility in that way. On the Sabbath at Challenger Camp, we fill up their Sabbath full. But after services and before Bible study, we had a discussion on taking ownership, where we broke down into the teams and sat there and just talked to them what it means to be personally responsible in terms of your calling in the church. How do we look at church services or socials? Is it ours or somebody else's? Do we come to church looking for a spiritual handout? Or do we come to church with something to give? Now, everybody wants to have inspiration at church. No question. I want to have inspiration at church. But we have to be able to come in and say, I have responsibility here to contribute, as compared to, I am coming here, please give me something to hold on to. If it's our congregation, our church, our body, then we will come here to produce. It changes our perspective. Are we owners or just participants? Randy Stiver and I came back from camp together. His family was visiting in Oregon. They were going to have a big social last weekend, and so the intent was that I would bring him as far as Boise, and then he would catch up with his wife, and then they would continue on, and I would stay, and then I could cover services down there, as was needful that week, there in Boise. And so I didn't have, in that sense, a chance where it was hooked up, but I did cover down there and visit with David and Pam Blue, and had a really wonderful weekend to be able to do that. But as we were coming back in the car, we had many discussions. We were rolling through the countryside and talking. We began to discuss the scriptures in reference to the Laodicean church. And now I will give you at least his and my opinion of that regard. We both believe that the Laodicean church is already in full force in terms of God's plan and time. That it is, in terms of the Church of God community, already firmly in place. If you can take the whole Church of God as a body, obviously I'm not speaking corporately, and if you can describe that as Philadelphian, then it is indeed a surprise to me. But again, we were trying then to describe in our own opinion as to when we thought maybe that transition had taken place. And he stepped back historically a little further than I had personally ever considered. My point in the sermon is not to describe that to you, but I want to describe the impact of the Laodicea and how that might impact us indeed if we buy in that way. Revelation 3, verse number 17, just the core of what the message was here, describing the Laodicean church. Revelation 3, 17, because you say, I'm rich, have become wealthy, and have need of nothing, and you do not know that you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. Because you cannot see spiritual weakness in yourself, you think you indeed have spiritual strength. I cannot even describe how many articles I've read, how many positions I've listened to, how many statements have been made, where someone was describing their strength and someone else's weakness. How they understood something, or they knew something, or they had arrived at a higher point and somebody else was still mired in a problem, or mired in an administration, or mired in something else, where they lifted themselves up and lowered somebody else off below them in the process. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire that you may be rich, white garments that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see. They could not see themselves spiritually. And they looked at the faults of others, and they ignored the faults themselves. They ignored what their own problems were themselves. I took off for the Tetons on a Sunday My intent was to try to leave, as is always, early on Sunday, and then later on Sunday, and then even later on Sunday, and finally, I'm headed out in the afternoon, and a couple more calls came in, and I stopped, and I went ahead and took the calls, and so then finally, about 6 o'clock, I was supposed to pick up one of my staff the next morning at Jackson Airport, and I had to leave in time to get to the airport, and about the last moment would have been 6, 7 o'clock in the evening for me if I just drove straight to the airport and picked him up. So I head out the door, get out to Coeur d'Alene, start up the hill, and the battery light comes on the Suburban. I'm pulling the self-contained trailer behind me that is my cousin's, and heading up the hill, and the light comes on, and I turn it around, and I head back, went over to the Lafferty's, and used their phone, and called Bill Barnhill, and said, "Bill, help, you know, bring your gauges, you know, let me know what's going on," and Starla jumps in the car, and Bill, and they come over, and he told me to meet him at the auto parts store, which I did, which closed before I got there by about 15 minutes. He checked the alternator and the battery and the gauges up, and he said, "Look, battery's fine. Your alternator is overcharging. You can't get an alternator tonight. It's too late." It was like 7:20, and they closed at 7, and we went to 3 or 4 stores right in that area, and every one of them was closing just by as we walked up. You know, they were open a few minutes late, but just as we'd walk up, they'd close the door and, you know, wave, I suppose, not really. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, I missed it by minutes. And it's Sunday night. There's no way I'm supposed to be at the airport in the morning. And so he says, "Well, you know, you can drive this thing." He says, "It's overcharging. You just bleed off as much juice as you can. And if it doesn't overcharge too much, you know, you won't melt your battery into a puddle as you go down the highway." I said, "All right, that sounds good to me." So I took off, and I had the front air on, the back air on, the lights on, had the radio on, I had anything I could juice, you know, and I'm watching the needle. And there's holding there, so I just drove through the night, and I'm watching that, and do this. The needle would just creep a little tiny bit up a little bit, and then hold, and then I would turn on the blinker, and I'd watch the needle go back down, you know. And then I'd turn the blinker off, and it would hold a bit. But, I mean, it was that close. I'm literally flipping on my blinker on and off through the night to see if I could bring that needle back, and I'm roaring down the highway because, you know, got to get to Jackson Airport. So south of Helena, finally that needle kind of pegged out. I said, "I'm going to destroy this thing." So I parked over and I prayed about it, and I sat there for about an hour and says, "All right, I got to go." And I fired that up, and now the needle was down low. It had dropped and gone the other direction. I said, "Well, that's not bad. On the average, I'm right in the middle." So I took off again. It was, you know, it was still 4 or 5 a.m. Nothing's open, whatever time it was still early enough. A little bit dark, so I'm now heading down the road, get down there to Bozeman, and still nothing's open. So, well, West Yellowstone, by the time I hit there, there'll be a parts store, and I'll fix it in West Yellowstone. Well, I didn't make it. Got out there in the open when it's completely desolate and no one's around, that needle just pegged down to the left on the bottom, and, of course, the lights are on all the time. I can't turn them off without, I suppose, unplugging them. But anyway, about 40 miles north of West Yellowstone, I just rolled off the side of the road. 6 a.m., it's raining. You know, I get out of the car, and there's rain running down my hat, and I'm standing there looking at the car, and a little bit disgusted by the whole thing. And trucker pulls up almost within minutes and says, "You know, I'm not supposed to do this, but I'll give you a ride." And takes me on into West Yellowstone. Get in about 7:30 in the morning. I know that's pretty good. I went over to the record place where they have the tow trucks. Of course, it doesn't open up for 30 minutes. Nobody there. And I figured, well, go over to the parts store. Get me an alternator. So I went over to the parts store and got the alternator. And they were open at 7:30. First one in the door. I watched him unlock. Gives me my alternator. Had one in stock. I walked back to the record place. And there's 5 people in line now, each with a crisis, which put me kind of out of the contention, obviously. And he has nothing he could do to help me. I have tow insurance, couldn't use it. I said, "That's okay. I got the alternator. I'll just hitch me a ride out of town. I'll get back up, fix that car, and I'll be on my way." He wished me the best. I stood out there for 3 hours on the edge of West Yellowstone. You couldn't beg a ride out of that town. I held the alternator up with my thumb for an hour. That didn't work. So I made me a sign. called Michelle. She said, have you made a sign? No, I haven't made a sign. But I made a sign, you know. Please, you know. Christian man. I held a sign up. Nothing. Nobody would stop the sign. So finally, I took out a $20 bill. I stood there for an hour with a $20 bill, and I couldn't buy a ride out of town. Nobody was going to pick me up out of that town. You know, I couldn't believe it. I felt like making a sign. I am not a bum. I am a human being with a job and a family, and I am a real person. Please help me. We stopped and met Mike at the parking lot in Spokane this morning, and there was a woman on the side of the road by the store with a gas can trying to hitch a ride to her car. How long do you think it took me to tell Derek, would you go take her to her car and come back and get me? It took about 3 seconds. All I had to do is see somebody needs a ride, you give her a ride. Derek took her with Michelle, they gassed her car, brought me back, or they were down Happy Valley, wherever it was, they were down there. But, you know, it did change my perspective a little bit in terms of needy people and circumstances they're in. But I finally had to go beg a ride. You know, you walk up to someone at a gas station, they see it coming, and they kind of turn their head away because, oh, no, you know, he's going to hit me up for beer money or something. So I'm walking around talking to people and trying to be pleasant, and then they'll look at you when you talk to them. And finally, I begged a ride out of town. A gentleman left his wife in the laundromat and took me out to my car. Now, we got to the car, and I didn't have all the tools I needed because you have to take the tension off the pulley, and I didn't have a breaker bar type of a thing. Well, wouldn't it be amazing? It turns out that only about 8 miles up the road the other direction was another wrecker service and an Ace hardware store. I went through in the dark and didn't know it was there, but we went to the wrecker, and he was on siesta or something. There was nobody around. Nobody knew where he was. Went over to the hardware store, bought the tools, and I went back and fixed it myself. It's not that tough. It's just an alternator. Changed it out. Kind of pleased. Now I have to start the car. Well, it won't start because the battery's dead. So I stood on the side of the road with jumper cables. And the cars are going vroom, vroom. Nobody stopped. Now, you know, sometimes I lose patience. And I walked around to the front, my hood's up on the Suburban, and finally I said, God, would you please get someone to help me? And the minute I said that in such an irreverent attitude, car pulled right up, pickup stopped right next to me, and the man leans out the door and says, can I help you? I just couldn't believe it. So I told him my plight, I told him how long it had been, how hard it had been, how everybody had abused me and everything, you know. And he stopped and he pulls around. We had to charge the battery up first so we could jump it without a big spark coming across. And he did. He was happy and he stopped. We got it running and I took off down the road. And, you know, I just thought, isn't that incredible? Now, I told that story a couple times in camp and, you know, add a little bit of embellishment to it and make it as glorious as I could, which wasn't very glorious, but... When I was after camp, we're all sitting at dinner, Randy Stiver, I'm there, and the Blues are there at the table, and I'm telling them the story. And after I finished the story, Randy just kind of looked over at me and says, well, couldn't you have just driven the car on the battery that was in the trailer? And I'm telling you, I was stunned. It's a self-contained trailer. On the front is a little black box. It's right out in the open with a little rubber strap on it and a little cloth thing. And all you have to do is pull it out of there and put it in your car and drive on into West Yellowstone and get your car fixed. I couldn't see it. In my mind, there was two different tow services that were unwilling or too busy or didn't care enough to help. There was 3 hours worth of northbound drivers out of West Yellowstone who hadn't helped me. There was the drivers who passed me going southbound while I stood out there with the jumper cables who hadn't helped me. And frankly, I was getting a little bit ticked off at God, you know, for not having supplied my needs and got me on the way. And yet, what I didn't realize is that instead of expecting someone to save me, being a participant, you know, waiting for someone to bring the boat to my apartment and sail me out of New Orleans and give me a job and a home and a bunch of cash somewhere else. that I had it within my hands to solve the problem within about 20 feet of where I was standing all along, and I didn't have to be saved at all. I could have saved myself. I couldn't see my own responsibility. Now, what happens when we do that spiritually? What happens when we come to church because somebody else has to inspire us? Obviously, God inspires us. What happens when we go to an activity because somebody else organized it? What happens when something goes wrong and it really wasn't our fault? What happens when we are simply participants waiting for someone else to fix it or to save us or to solve the problem instead of taking responsibility and resolving it for ourselves? With God's help, with His guidance and direction. What happens when we are just participants? Ephesians 6 talks about the armor of God. And we've had sermonettes. We've had instruction on the armor of God. You have to put the armor on. Putting on the armor of God is not like calling the police. If there's a problem and you call the police, that is their solution. They will fix it. They will fix it for you. Putting on the armor of God is where you address it yourself spiritually. With God's guidance and direction, by His power. There's no question about that. But that's ownership. And it's different from simply being a participant. Let me give you a couple of examples of God's people in this way. The book of Esther, chapter 4. We have the story here where Naaman is trying to destroy the Jews in that land. And where he went to the king and got permission to have a decree that would go out and legally make it possible to destroy the Jews. Mordecai, having heard of this, and then sending a message to Esther, who is now the queen, but a queen who cannot simply do as she pleases, cannot simply walk into the king's presence, and so he sends and encourages Esther to intercede on their behalf. And she says, I really cannot. But then again, he reminds her, and notice how she takes responsibility in a personal way. In the book of Esther here, chapter 4, verse 12, they told Mordecai Esther's words. Mordecai told them to answer her back. Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? How do we not know that God has not called us to be the one to intercede on His behalf in this way? By His power, but in this way. Then Esther told them to return this answer to Mordecai. Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan, fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. If I perish, I perish. That's ownership. I will do it. I will put my life on the line for all of us. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods. Oh, I'm sorry, my parents won't let me do that. My parents will never let me bow down to an idol. I just can't do it. I would get such a spanking like you couldn't imagine. Let it be known, O king, that we do not serve your gods. You know, think about David and Goliath. Mainly David, obviously. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Who in the world do you think you are, defying God's people? That's not participant. That's ownership. He went out there with his life in his hands to serve God. Look at 2 Kings chapter 2. A little different example. This is what I wanted our young people to understand. I wanted them to know that this was their camp, that it was their team, that it was their activity. When they were participating in it, that it was their responsibility to succeed, to participate, to accomplish, to learn, to overcome. That they're not just doing it for me, that they're doing it because they are called of God into His service, and that they should learn those lessons and apply them well. 2 Kings 2, verse number 1. It says, it came to pass when the Lord was about to take Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. And Elijah said to Elisha, stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to Bethel. And Elisha said, as the Lord lives, as your soul lives, I'll not leave you. And they went on down to Bethel. Elijah was almost maybe even testing him a little bit. He says, go away, don't worry about it, I'll take care of this myself. And Elisha says, I will not let you take care of this yourself. I will be with you. You know, imagine, you know, Naomi. Imagine Ruth and the example that was set there. So the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said, do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today? Apparently it had been expressed. Elijah had maybe known and had expressed it to them. And they're coming up to Elisha and he says, yes, I know. Keep silent. Don't bring it up. Leave it alone. Let it be. Elijah said to him, Elisha, stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me on to Jericho. And he said, as the Lord lives, as your soul lives, I'll not leave you. They went to Jericho. He never signed off. He never backed off. He says, no, I'm in this too. I'm with you. I want to be here when this happens. I want to be at your side. The sons of the prophets who were at Jericho came to Elisha and said, do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today? And he answered, yes, I know. Keep silent. Let it be. Leave it alone. Then Elijah said to him, stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me unto Jordan. He said, as the Lord lives, as your soul lives, I will not leave you. The two of them went on. So it's not like Elijah forbade him from participating, but he says, take your leisure, go ahead and go back. Don't worry about it today. And he says, no, we are in this. I am with you. 50 of the men of the sons of the prophets went and stood facing in the distance while the two of them stood by the Jordan. Now Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, struck the water, and it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. And so it was when they had crossed over that Elijah said to Elisha, ask, what may I do for you before I am taken away from you? And Elisha said, please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. Give me the power to do what needs to now be done. You're leaving. I am going to be here. I want to be able to do the work. He took ownership. He wasn't asking for recognition. He wasn't asking for authority over people so that he could be their Lord and Master. He was asking for access to God's Spirit in a greater way. Elijah couldn't give that to him. He says, it is up to God. But God said, that is okay. I will give you what you need. Do you ever feel like you're not up to the task? You ever feel like you don't know what you need to know? You don't understand what you need to understand? God says, ask me. Let me give you the power. Let me give you the strength to do those things. Because you took ownership. Because it was yours to do and it had to be done. I just think that's a remarkable example. The war of the worlds. There's Satan's world. And there's God's world. And there's a war between them. One of the other things we discussed in the context of writing, Randy Stiver and I back from camp, he was saying, well, it's interesting, at least from my perspective, that when something's happening spiritually, that there's also something happening physically. And I've heard this discussed from different perspectives. When there's something happening in the financial market, sometimes there's something happening in the church. When there's something happening on the world scene, sometimes there's something else happening spiritually in the church in a related way. Excuse me, in a related way. Look at Revelation 12. You know, Matthew, God said through Matthew that there'd be wars and rumors of wars in the process of coming up to the end. But look at Revelation 12, verse number 7. It says, war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. The dragon and his angels fought. They didn't prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So a great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast down to the earth. His angels were cast out with him. You know, what's the context of this? What's the time frame? Well, it says that I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been cast down. So we already have the brethren in that sense. Salvation now is coming. It's the kingdom of our God has come. So we're at the end time. We're in the context of the end time and the finishing of these things. The saints are being accused. They're being castigated. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. Christ's sacrifice had taken place, and now they have access to that. By the word of their testimony, they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. And we know prophetically that Satan is going to be cast into restraint as the millennium is established, as the kingdom of God is set up. And so in the time frame before Satan is confined, it says when he has a short time left, there is a great spiritual war that takes place. Now when you look on the ground, if you believe indeed that that end time is approaching, I certainly do. I believe the circumstances that we have seen prophetically, and it's been mentioned in our literature, I've mentioned it at times in some of my sermons as well in terms of reference. But you just look around. Right now there's a battle on the ground between Israel and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. There's a war that is taking place in Iraq. There's another war taking place in Afghanistan. There is the chance and the possibility of a war widening into Syria and also into Iran. I believe from things I've read and what I understand that literally Iran is actually trying to provoke an open conflict, to try to bleed the United States out, maybe, to bleed Israel out or Europe out. There are difficulties in North Africa, in Sudan, and in other places. There are difficulties that have the same roots in the Muslim world and the desire to achieve dominion that are in Eastern Europe. I heard yesterday a reference being made to the fact that until the dominion of Islam reached all the way to Spain, they would not have what it is that they have demanded. And again, that is a temporary step for those who are wanting to accomplish those things. Why Spain? Because the Muslims once controlled Spain before, and they will never, never concede what has once been conquered. Because the intent is ultimately, finally, to conquer the world. There is a war going on spiritually. There are wars that are building physically as well. World War III began to play out back in the 70s and has been building ever since. You can go through the Achille Lauro, you can go through Lebanon, you can go through the Marine Barracks, you can go through, you know, the Yemen, you can go through many of those incidents, the World Trade Center, the towers, you can go through the terrorist groups and the expansion of the groups and the way that they have been funded and the way that they have tried to coordinate and cooperate with each other. It is a war that is building on this earth. Prophecy shows that there is a war that will also be taking place spiritually at that time. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that is indeed what is going to be playing out. In the process of that, we have to ask ourselves, are we bystanders? Are we participants? Or have we bought in? Is it our church and our people and our gospel and this work, is it our work? Yes, it's God's work. But we are his servants. Are we there because we are shepherds of the sheep who will lay down our lives for the sheep? Or are we there because someone else has responsibility and if trouble should come, then we should indeed flee? We were trying to express that to our young people. I would like to offer it to each of us. Indeed, there is a war of the worlds. And we need to ask ourselves, which world are we fighting for? Which world are we in?